Howdy, listener, and thanks for tuning into our podcast, The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. My name is Izzy.
And my name is David. Each week, one of us will pick a movie that the other has not seen. We will deep dive into our individual takes and historical background of the movie.
Please subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Instagram at TML A Journey Through Cinema and Twitter at TML A Journey.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. This week we are traveling to 2005 to discuss a film that I remember enjoying and I thought, what the heck? Let's look at it.
This week's episode will be Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, starring Robert Downey Jr., Val Kilmer, and Michelle Monaghan, directed by Shane Black. For those who haven't seen the movie, let me tell you a little bit about it. Harry Lockhart, played by Robert Downey Jr., is a crook from New York who wins a part he auditioned for while running away from the police. While in Hollywood, Harry is thrown into a murderous conspiracy with an actress, Harmony Lane, a girl Harry had a crush on back in school, and a private eye, Perry, played by Val Kilmer. So why did you pick this film? We did have another film on the books, so why did you switch to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
We did have another movie in our slot for this episode. And I picked Kiss Kiss Bang Bang because it's that crime hard-boiled type of neo-noir that we like to watch. And it's a film that didn't get seen a lot when it came out because Robert Downey Jr. was in that area before he made Iron Man. He wasn't as popular as he is now. And Shane Black had just finished The Long Kiss Goodnight. He didn't direct it. He wrote it. And it was like the third screenplay that he had written that underperformed. So he was kind of in that area of trying to rebuild his career again. And then Val Kilmer also was in it. And he was kind of in that weird area where his career started to go. So a lot of people didn't see it. And I remember watching it thinking, oh, this is a really fun film. It has a lot of potential. It's not perfect. I remember it not being perfect. So I'm not going to say that when I went back to watch this film saying, this is a hidden gem. I just remember enjoying it and thinking that it'd be a fun film to talk about because it is kind of not perfect. So there's a lot of things to kind of talk about it. So that's why I picked it. As a replacement film for the film that we had, it was also nothing like that film. So when we go back and talk about that film eventually, it's not like we talked about two films from the same genre. So, and we hadn't really talked about a neo-noir in our podcast. I like film noir. I like, and then some of the updated film neo-noirs of the 1990s and early 2000s are really fun because, you know, they're re-examining the genre. So that's why I picked it.
You mentioned that we do like to watch a lot of mysteries. We have talked about it probably on this podcast before, that we like to watch a lot of mysteries. So to you, what makes a good mystery movie?
Mysteries as a genre is really broad. It can be anything from Miss Marple and that British countryside mystery to the hard-boiled detective in L.A. trying to figure out which rich person was trying to hide the fact that they murdered somebody and what the conspiracy really was. So there's a really wide range in that genre. For me, though, it has to do with you have to have an interesting detective. An interesting detective usually means the character is flawed in some way or rebounding or down on their luck, or there's all these different versions of that character. Sometimes when I watch these films, the character is so flawed. It's like, how does this person get up and tie their shoes and get out the door? And so it has to be that balance. Is when they layer in a flawed character with a redemption story with the they did something bad back in their in the day, that they the secret that will take them down if everybody finds out. It's like, come on, dude, this character has this character is so unrealistic that it takes you out of it. So having that interesting character for me, the interesting detective, having a really good mystery, like you don't want it to be so obscure that there was no chance of you figuring it out, but also not so easy that and the person walks in the room minute 15, we all point at the screen and go, that's it, that's the guy. And everybody figures out, okay, now we're just going to see how he did it. Unless you structure the story that way. There are some of these stories where you know who the killer is and it's structured in the way of, will he get away with it or won't he? That's a whole, that's a subgenre of this, of the mystery. So, I find that's the two biggest things. Good mystery that keeps you in the edge of seat, but isn't so out there that you can't figure it out. And, a good detective. What do you think a good mystery is?
Well, I do agree with you on those two things. You need to have a solid plan. You know, it can't just be make no sense. The mystery, the end of the mystery can't just be pulled out of thin air. It has to make sense. A good detective is fundamental to a film because they are usually our narrator. And if we can't stand our narrator, then we can't really follow the mystery. One of the things that I would add as well, I think it's really good when a mystery doesn't focus solely on the mystery. It adds a little bit more of dynamics and tension when it's about somebody else, like when there's something else going on. Either it's like the love interest is in trouble or will they get together at the end. One of my favorite ones so far of the last 5 years has been the I think it was Amazon Prime's ABC Murders with John Malkovich as Poirot, because of the fact that it also focused on politics and immigration, and I thought in the 1920s, and I thought that was very interesting as well. And I think when mysteries do that, it allows us to explore, very similar to how horror films let us explore, what makes us human, why would we hurt somebody, what is the thing that would make us snap. And I really enjoy watching those kind of movies.
I remember that we watched that because we couldn't imagine John Malkovich playing Hercule Poirot. But I have to say, honestly, although it's not a very traditional take on that character, I did find the film very interesting because it wasn't the traditional take on Poirot. And I think that's one of the things that I enjoy too, is that you're watching somebody else's interpretation of that story. So it's pretty interesting. In 2005, after The Long Kiss Goodnight had come out, and it didn't do as well as it was anticipated of doing, and I think it was like the third script that Shane Black had written that had underperformed. And so he decided, I'm going to write a traditional romantic comedy or romantic story with about these two kids that meet up in L.A., and they kind of come from screwed-up backgrounds. And as he started writing it, he got a little bit of writer's block, and he said, screw it, there's going to be a murder. And he brought in this inspiration from the story from Brett Holiday from the book called Bodies Are Where You Find Them, and he started writing the story, which would eventually become the script for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. This wasn't the first time that he was inspired by Brett Holiday's books. Back in 2001, he started writing a screenplay based on Brett Holiday's book, Blue Murder. And that was the screenplay that would eventually turn into The Nice Guys, which Shane Black directed, and it came out in 2016, although they shot it in 2014. I'm not exactly sure why there was a delay there. But it was a really fun movie. And so the funny thing is I'm watching Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. The entire time I'm like going, we probably should have watched The Nice Guys.
Even though we both have seen The Nice Guys, so it would kind of break our formula, but we I would say that we both enjoyed The Nice Guys more than we enjoyed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
So Kiss Kiss Bang Bang reminds me of the punk band's Garage album. That's like, there's a couple good songs on it that gets them signed and gets them a following and they become famous. And then The Nice Guys is like their third album that was like, they're more polished. They're still angry and they're still doing all the punk stuff. Like The Nice Guys still has the convoluted plot, still has the people in power trying to cover up their bad deeds and the down on their luck detectives or detective wannabe. And it's just, the stories are very similar, I think, because they had the same root. I don't know how, I haven't read Brett Holliday's books, but so I don't know how close you are to the books. I would suggest that they're probably more inspired by them than direct adaptations. And they, for me, it just felt like it was a much more finished, and the plot made, the convoluted plot made more sense at the end of The Nice Guys than Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But if you kind of view them in the same world, it kind of makes sense. I still give Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, like that Garage album, it would still give it good reviews, but there's a lot of areas of opportunity for improvement.
Yeah, I felt like there was a couple of scenes that could have been nipped and tucked a little bit. I think the dialogue, even though it's still as witty, I think it could have been, with Kiss Kiss King, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, I feel like some of the dialogue felt a little forced, you know, like when there's a naturally quippy person versus a quippy person who's just saying things that they found on the internet. That's kind of how I felt with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Well, I think Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is one of those movies where it was his first time directing, and Robert Downey Jr. is really talented, so he'll probably say a line five different ways that make it that you fall in love with. And it'd be like really hard to edit and pick your favorite ones. And so I feel like in a weird way that they may have fallen in love with a couple scenes with him that didn't get edited down, which isn't a bad thing, because Robert Downey Jr. at the top of his game is a lot of fun to watch. And I found that sometimes when the story started to sag a little bit and he was being very charming and just holding that movie together, that's fine. And it reminded me too a lot of, like, in a weird sort of way, it reminded me a lot of the film noir films I watched from the 40s, 50s, and 60s that aren't the super famous ones, the ones that would show up on Saturday afternoon cinema, or the ones that directors directed before they got famous. Like Kubrick directed one called The Killing, and there's a couple other ones that just popped into my head. They had good casts, but the plots were kind of basic or derivative, or sometimes got lost. And somehow at the end, they wrapped it all up, and it was a good film. There was flaws. There was actors and actresses that were good and okay, but and stuff like that. And this film kind of harkened back to that. I actually found this kind of, again, that homemade charm. It's hard to say homemade charm in a Hollywood film that has Robert Downey Jr., produced by Joel Silver, one of the biggest producers in Hollywood. But if you know about the history of the film, it had a very small budget, and they had to do a lot of stuff on the fly. In fact, they filmed one of the scenes at Shane Black's house and stuff like that. So it's like, it's just one of those things where it's, for me, it has that kind of gritty, yes, we can attitude that I like about filmmaking. Sometimes I really enjoy flawed films more than perfect films, because you see you see what the people are going for, and life is messy. And sometimes when you watch a flawed film, it kind of connects a little bit more with you. It's like you see the potential and you're like, oh, I really wanted this to, but it gets really close and you go, okay, I see what you guys were trying to do. I give you points for that.
I felt very similar in that style, where it did feel very homegrown. I really enjoyed a lot of parts of this movie, one of my favorite clips from the movie is when Robert Downey Jr. falls over the interstate sign and holds on to the hand of the corpse for protection. And I just found that really absurd, and I really enjoyed it. And that was kind of the charm of the movie, where it's it has this macabre feel to it, but it's still, you can laugh at it because it's not so, like, so sad because I was, you know, it's not so sad and so dark that you can't laugh at it.
And there are some dark undertones to this film. And it does deal with the fact that the people that, all these people come from really bad childhoods. And, like, her father, the person that Robert Downey Jr.'s character is chasing, Harmony Lane, played by Michelle Monaghan, is her dad was molesting her sister, but also beating her. So it's implied that he was beating her. And so it was they came from a very broken household. And so it's just like, that's a very dark thing to have in the story. And although they never made fun of that, it was they treated that very seriously. There was light humor and there was absurdist humor in this film. It also had that thing of, like, a lot of film noirs had that vague ending where there's always that one person that should have gotten their comeuppance in the film that didn't. And it's just the way it is. It's just, life is that way. It's like, not everybody, I mean, the main bad guy in the film gets taken care of. Not every bad guy is taken care of, which is a little bit more realistic.
So there are certain characters in this movie, like Harmony Lane and Harry Lockhart, who kind of fit in these certain film noir tropes. You know, you got the detective type, that sexy femme fatale. But there's this private eye character played by Val Kilmer, who in this movie is a homosexual. And one of the reasons why Shane Black wrote that character is that he was trying to reinvent the genre of mystery. He never saw a character like that, you know, who broke down doors and shot people and was ball busting. Who happened to be gay. Do you think with characters like this and with the plot, with the mix of romance and humor and darkness, do you think that he has reinvented the genre? Or do you think this is just another film noir adaptation?
I applaud him trying to do that. I think it was handled very heavy-handedly. So it kind of took away the change that he would have made with that role if he had dealt with it in a much more subtle way. I don't think we need to sit there and give somebody a nickname, Gay Perry, so everybody knows that he's gay. What we need to do is find ways to tell the story so you don't have to use nicknames like that. On the flip side, Val Kilmer's character was, you know, a very interesting character, and he was one of those guys who knew he wasn't a good guy. He lived on the edges. He did some not nice things for very powerful people, and sometimes it leaned on the good, and sometimes it leaned on the bad, but he was paid to do certain things and he did it. So that was one of the things that I thought was a very interesting character. So I don't think he really reinvented the character. If that character is truly going to be reinvented, it's just going to be part of the story. It's not going to be handed so overtly like that.
I feel like most of his dialogue was pretty much equivalent of like, hey, I'm gay, I'm going to shoot you, you know?
Well, no, there was a lot of it, they didn't talk about it. I thought it was really funny. It was like, there was that first scene at the beginning of the movie that kind of set that up where you find out what his nickname is. And then they move on. And then it comes back later on, and it's like, wait, why are you bringing this back up again? And so it was kind of funny because there was a period, Robert Downey Jr. is narrating the film to you, and he is very self-aware. It's almost Deadpoolish in the way how self-aware he is. And how
that's a really good point. I didn't think about that, but yeah, it does kind of have that same mark with a mouth sense of humor.
Yeah, and so there'd be things like, this is the scene where this is gonna get called back later on because this is important, or something like that, or he would say something, and it was obviously a nod to the type of genre of film they're making, or a nod to Hollywood in general. And I always thought it was interesting that they never came back and made a comment about that. If you're going to be so blatant about that in the first couple minutes about Perry's nickname, then at that point and you're telling people there's going to be callbacks, there should be a callback. So obviously it was just, so for me, I just find it like, oh, they didn't know how to do it. They didn't know how to put that character in there and make it so natural feeling in the story.
Do you think with the narration devices that Shane Black uses kind of help the energy of the movie a little bit?
Yes. I think that the thing is that it's one of those films that film lovers will like because it will point out things about the films and genre as it's doing it. They were using Raymond Chandler titles as title cards in the movie, to the different chapters. They're calling back to that era. There's definitely other callbacks to Mickey Spillane and Dashiell Hammett too. So there's callback to the two famous film noir movies as well as pulp novels.
I honestly think this is kind of like a love letter to those type of pulp novels and those film noir films, because all the references are handled with care. They're not over explaining themselves. They're not like, this is a reference to this one book that's really influential to me. This is a shot taken from this movie, you know, like some other directors do. But this was a very beautiful love letter to film noir.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing, he has always been inspired by that. He has admitted that he's been inspired very young in those type of stories. His first major screenplay was Lethal Weapon, which definitely has some callback to that. And even though it's a big 80s Hollywood film, it definitely has that callback. And so I think the thing, it felt like a first-time director. The tone was a little uneven. There were scenes where the actor kind of took over the scene and didn't necessarily fit in the movie. There are scenes where at one point everybody's distraught and then it's forgotten and then it's brought back again. So, I mean, but there's hilarious, absurdist moments in this film, like when he loses his finger and finding out how some of the story has gone. It's definitely absurdist humor. And then, of course, it's mixed with that dark storyline. So it does give you that kind of that nihilistic point of view.
Did you think this movie just ended?
Well, it felt to me like it was the original ending they weren't happy with, so they tacked on that little ending at the end.
Yeah, I felt he made a comment in his narration. Robert Downey Jr.'s character made a comment where he was saying, "Oh, I saw the Return of the King," which I thought was funny. I saw the Return of the King. I won't make this movie have 19 endings, right? And he made that comment, which, first of all, really hilarious, was one of many comments that kind of dated this film. But he said that, but it had three different endings, but none of them kind of smoothed into each other.
Well, I think that's kind of like some of the self-awareness of the film. I think the ending should have been in the hospital. Like when he makes fun of the all American Hollywood ending where the guy you thought was dead comes back, all that kind of stuff. And that should have been the ending. And then it goes on for two more endings.
Yeah, I also had a problem with that ending because it just felt very like, the mystery's over, woohoo! Because it's like, they, spoiler alert, murder a bunch of people. And so does the murderer people. They've murdered all the murderer people. So there's no, even though they are technically the good guys, there's never this like thought. It's always like, it's Christmas. Your Christmas gift is that you didn't go to jail. It's like, that's it. That's all the we get of the consequences of this movie.
No, because I think the thing is that that's not the type of movie it is. The thing that's very interesting to me when people are making homage films or books or stories just to things that they really love is they have to pick and choose. Live with those choices all the way through. You can't love all the parts of why you love something. And so I felt that's one of the reasons why this film was a little uneven, is that like he was trying to have his cake and eat it too in some cases. And what you're talking about is like the ending not having consequences. In a lot of those films that he loved and grew up with, they didn't have that either. The mystery is over. Black card goes up. You find out who did it, and we move on. So that's just, for me, it's just a call back to that genre. I mean, if you wanted them to all have consequences, he would have set up the film differently.
That makes sense to the point. Also, Val Kilmer in a beard. That last scene, I was like, why does he have a beard? There's no beard at all. I just thought that was so funny.
Well, it's supposed to be a year later. And it literally could have been a year later. I don't know when they shot that scene. So it was supposed to be a year later. So
no, I know. But it's still like, Val Kilmer in a beard. I'm just going to show up. You know, I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, ponytail too. Did you see that?
No, I did not. This is a weird question, but do you think that this movie shows that Robert Downey Jr. is a brilliant actor and can survive without Marvel? It's been a very weird topic to read about, and it's a popular topic with film critics and Robert Downey Jr. fans since he's left Iron Man and Marvel as an actor and is trying to do bigger and better things. Do you think that this movie kind of proves the fact that he doesn't need Marvel to be a good actor?
Well, there's a couple things there that we need to talk about, because I think that one thing is that people are saying that Robert Downey Jr. needs Marvel to have the success that he had during Marvel. He's never going to have the same success monetarily. None of his movies that he makes now, maybe one, will ever be as huge as Iron Man 3. Which is like one of like the top 12 movies of all time. Shane Black directed. Yeah, which he brought back Shane Black to direct when they were looking for directors. And so you can never repeat that. And so it's like when a band has that huge album and the next album comes out and it does really well, and people said, oh, they're not as big as they used to be. You can't replicate that stuff, and people need to stop expecting that replication. For Robert Downey Jr. to be successful is for him to make films that are good, that he's good in, that are really good and fun for us to watch. He made the film The Judge, which I enjoyed, and then he made Doolittle, which I did not enjoy. But that doesn't mean that he needs Marvel to be a quote-unquote success. That's if you're going to go just about what films make as your only rating for success, then most actors at a certain point are no longer successful, because as actors and actresses get older or they move on, they've done the big budget films, they want to do something different. They want to do something that challenges them in a different way. And so it's like, I get really annoyed when I read those type of stories. Like, he hasn't made a movie as successful since Iron Man. Well, it's like, or since the last Avengers movie. It's like, well, those are like world beater films. Those films come out and the whole world is waiting for those. So I don't know how you could ever make a movie bigger than that. And so for me, what I'm looking forward to is some of the smaller stuff he's talking about doing, some of the more intimate stuff he's talking about doing, as well as some of the other projects that he has signed up for. I'm really looking forward to that. I want to see where he goes. I've seen the big budget Robert Downey Jr. in Marvel Land, and I don't need to see it again. And I don't need the films to be that big or that ambitious. I want it to be fun and interesting. And fun and interesting doesn't mean light either. It means a film that really has something to it. And so, yes, I think this film does prove that he doesn't need Marvel, because he was already making good and interesting films before. I think what Iron Man and Marvel did is reassert just how talented he was, because that's a tightrope to be that good and interesting in a blockbuster film like that. It's really hard.
Well, also, without this movie, he does not get cast in Iron Man.
I had always heard that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang led to Iron Man, but I had never read it anywhere. So when you said that, I was like,
it's on IMDb, so it must be true. You never know, you know?
No, but like I'm talking about back in the day, like back when Iron Man came out, that Kiss Kiss Bang Bang led to Iron Man, which is why Robert Downey Jr. was really instrumental in Shane Black coming and directing Iron Man 3 because of Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And I remember reading that somewhere, hearing that somewhere, but this is like how many years later? I just thought I made that up in my head. So when you said that, I was kind of shocked. Like, oh, I guess I did read that.
Well, I also, while I was reading, a lot of people credit Marvel with Robert Downey Jr.'s rise again, and they always say like Marvel put Robert Downey Jr. on the map. It's all Marvel. It's all Marvel. Marvel was the one who gave him his first job after blah 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 blah. And I think this movie gets swept underneath the rug with Robert Downey Jr., which is funny because Robert Downey Jr. in interviews has said that this is his favorite movie that he's made.
Yeah, it's really fun.
But it gets swept under the rug because less than, 2000, this is 2005, 2008, Iron Man comes out.
Yeah. As we know in this world, is that once a certain narrative is set, it's really hard for the actual narrative to come out. And people just want to believe that Iron Man made Robert Downey Jr.'s career. But I remember there being other movies that he was making at the time that were very interesting.
This movie has a big name cast. They got Val Kilmer. They got Robert Downey Jr. They have Corbin Bernson. But all these actors aren't what we would consider on the top of their game career-wise, which I think is one of the reasons why it gets swept under the rug, is because with Val Kilmer, when I say Val Kilmer, there's many movies that pop into your head, but Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is not one of them. When I say Robert Downey Jr., Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is not one of them. So it gets swept under the rug a little bit because this was a downhill for Val Kilmer as well as a downhill / uphill for Robert Downey Jr. in their careers.
Well, he was making interesting, Robert Downey Jr. was making interesting films before Iron Man. I mean, he was in Zodiac, which came out the year before Iron Man. I don't know if it was filmed at the same time, because I know that there's a lot of special effects in Iron Man, but he was in Zodiac. He was in, what was the other film? Good Night and Good Luck. He was in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He was in that, like I mentioned earlier, the remake of The Singing Detective, which is another one of those flawed films that I enjoyed his performance in. His performance was really good in it. The film, the thing about taking a miniseries and making a film out of it is there's so much stuff they're trying to cram into that film. But I felt it was a valid attempt. I still think it's a flawed film, but it's fun to watch. And his performance is really good. His performance in A Scanner Darkly was also a really good performance. So he had like a lot of really good performances before Iron Man. It wasn't like he was like not working and all of a sudden got plunked out. And I think he would have.
That's kind of the narrative that they tried to push.
Yeah. I don't think they. I don't think. I mean, Marvel.
No, I'm not saying they as in like Marvel or Disney. It's just kind of like. That's the narrative that many people think.
Well, there's a thing of, I didn't notice him before, so therefore this must be the thing that broke him out. And it's like, just because you notice something doesn't mean it didn't exist before you were there. And that's kind of an important thing with film, because films layer on top of each other, and some films are made as direct responses to other films. Some films inspire other filmmakers. You watch films from other countries and you go, oh my God, that's a great, and then you think about it and you get inspired by it and you make your, you do another, you do your version of it. So I don't really view like the Iron Man as the culmination of his career. I think he's had a really good career through it. And there's been ups and downs, of course. There's been all these, he's very open about that. And I think that for me, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is like one of those films that he has a really good performance in, a flawed film, which makes it really fun to watch, you know? And I think Shane Black had really grown as a director. So by the time he got to The Nice Guy, the film really benefits from what he learned on Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, what he learned on Iron Man 3. And he did a really good job of mixing the different tones and the darkness with the humor and the black comedy with the story. So I found it a little bit more interesting.
It to me kind of reminded me of when you watch like comedy, mystery shows like Psych and things like that. Like, definitely much darker than Psych, but there are definite dark episodes and dark themes throughout. Mm-hmm. Comedy, you know, comedy mysteries like with Monk and The Mentalist and things like that, but you're allowed to laugh even though you're surrounded with murder.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's a very common way of making the story interesting. Do you feel that this film, would you recommend this film to somebody?
It's a very complicated question for this particular movie, because I enjoyed bits and pieces of it, like the coffin on the freeway sign and him falling over and holding it. I thought it was very funny, some of those callbacks to like how Hollywood works, where it's like, this scene's going to be cut, you know, this scene's going to be referenced later. Pay attention, y'all. And I like some parts of it, but to me, sometimes it's a little rough around the edges for me to appreciate the darkness. Because sometimes with movies, why are you going dark when it doesn't need to be dark? Or the dark parts would be a little bit better highlighted if you didn't, you know, put weird things in front of the screen. And I'm like, what? You know, so it's like, it's a hard movie to like go to your friends and be like, you should watch this because of these reasons. But I really did think it was an interesting movie, and it did, if you like film noir and you like dark senses of humor and things like that, I think it does really resonate with an audience like that. But if you're a particular person who's like, I like my murder mysteries more on the comedy and lighter side, I wouldn't recommend it. But that's one of the reasons why mystery as a genre is so wide, is because some people like a little bit of mystery with their comedy, and some like a little bit of comedy with their mystery. So would you recommend this movie, Dad?
I don't know, because it doesn't age as well as I remember it. I remember enjoying it, thinking it was kind of funny. Like I said, I always remembered it as a flawed film. I just didn't realize that there was so many tonal issues with it. But if you're really into, like you said, noir film, especially neo-noir films from the 90s and early 2000s, it's a good example of one. And Downey's performance and Val Kilmer's performance hold the film together. They're really good. And Michelle Monaghan is really good. So, I mean, all the playing is great in it. And the mystery is enough that you go, oh, I see what's going on now. Yeah, there's a little bit of letdown at the end when you find out all the story of what's behind it. But that's kind of the point of the movie, too. Like, a lot of stories that Hollywood makes all these grand movies and stuff, but this actual story of Hollywood is kind of a letdown. That's kind of a theme going through the entire movie. So it works. The ending works. And so that's about it. I think the film is a nice performance by the leads. The director, the first time director, does a good job of getting it to the end. I just think you see his growth by the time he does The Nice Guys that, oh, he's really grown as a director.
I agree with that, and I also would say if you want to watch something, I would recommend watching this and The Nice Guys to kind of see how
he grows,
because The Nice Guys is a really good movie.
I think The Nice Guys is a really good movie, and ironically, it's also a movie that now people didn't see. It's kind of funny. They were made almost 10 years to the difference. One was come out in 2005, the other one came out in 2016, although they filmed it in 2014. I'm talking about The Nice Guys. They came out almost 10 years apart from each other, and both of them didn't really find their audience until later on. I think The Nice Guys will probably go down longer. There's been a talk of having a sequel to it.
Yeah, we didn't watch The Nice Guys until probably a year later.
Yeah, and I think that's probably also because some of the marketing misled what the movie was about. And I think we watched the original trailer for Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and quite frankly, it kind of misled what that movie was about. So I can see why they wouldn't find this audience.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this episode of The Movie Log, A Journey Through Cinema. If you did enjoy, please subscribe or leave a review. Or you can follow us on Instagram at TML, A Journey Through Cinema, or on Facebook at The Movie Log. Next week, we will be going back in time to the Renaissance. How are we going to do that? We'll find out next week.
Thanks for listening.